On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. Today's training was developed by the ITRC team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentations over to our ITRC trainers. Today's training is based on the online guidance document, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. We're going to introduce you to this guidance during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording the session. Trainers are going to control the slides during today's class. If you would like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. We do look for your interaction throughout today's training. You are welcome to type in questions or comments in that Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, we're going to ask those questions out loud. And if you're on the phone line, you're also welcome to unmute and ask questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do look for your feedback, and we have a feedback form that we're going to ask you to complete. We would like everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. One of the advantages of the feedback form is you can create a certificate of participation for attending today's class. You need to attend the class, fill out the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system will generate a certificate for you, and right now that's the only way to get that certificate, so please fill out the feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. It's a great time to look at the new teams. There's new teams starting this year. If you're interested in becoming more involved in ITRC, it's a great process. I do encourage you to visit the website to learn more. Our trainers today were members of the ITRC Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls team. If you would like to read their bios, those are available on that CLUIN training page. A link is available in your registration and reminder emails, also on the middle right in the related links. So if you select CLUIN training page, if you look down a bit, select Browse To, you can see the bios for all of our trainers today. Our first trainer today is Kevin Shrims from the Michigan DEQ, and I'm going to turn it over to Kevin.
Thank you, Juliana, and thank you to all the attendees who are participating today. We're really excited for the opportunity to introduce to you our institutional control guidance document, which is now available. Before the other trainers dive into the specifics of the guidance, I want to take some time setting the stage for institutional controls and lay the groundwork how our guidance document was developed. Now, for many of you on the call, the concept of leaving contamination in place was previously not an acceptable way of achieving closure under most regulatory programs. Most programs require contamination to be cleaned up to background or native concentrations. Clean up meant clean up. But since the mid-1990s, risk-based corrective action, the Rebecca process, and the use of institutional controls has become an important part of many federal, state, and local cleanup and brownfield programs. ICs are generally administrative or legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure now and into the future to contamination and to protect the integrity of the selected remedy. ICs have helped fuel redevelopment and reduce the cost and time to achieve closure at many sites. Now, as an aside, Michigan, the state that I am from, has had the tagline of R for R, or remediation for redevelopment. emphasizing considering sites for remediation work, but based on the potential for redevelopment of the site and the environmental and public health risk, as well as the economic benefit. Now, for more background discussion of institutional controls, you can read ITRC's 2008 document, which is noted in the last bullet point on the slide in front of you. A little bit of a summary from that 2008 guidance document. I want to make sure that we all know about terminology and the different terms that are used in our guidance document and understanding the differences between those. The terminology and process descriptions used in our guidance document is consistent with those in the EPA Superfund CERCLA program. The picture on the right half of the screen also visually illustrates the differences between engineering controls, which are those physical barriers, such as vapor barriers, physical or hydraulic containment, asphalt or concrete, vapor mitigation systems. On the other hand, when we use the term institutional controls, those are more of our paper descriptions of the legal descriptions, and they help protect the integrity of the engineering control or minimize the potential for human exposure to the contamination. Both engineering controls and institutional controls are incorporated under the umbrella of land use controls, and that are used to provide protection from exposure to contaminants that exist or remain at a site. Now, upon initiating the process of developing this guidance, ITRC understood that state agencies use ICs at contaminated sites as remedies. However, we did not know the full extent of their use. ITRC also did not understand the various state agency institutional control selection process and implementation process or the regulatory framework governing institutional controls. It can vary from state to state. ITRC finally wanted to gather the information to determine how states manage and even fund institutional controls once they're in place, along with any data indicating that state agencies may be performing a monitoring, tracking, enforcement, or stakeholder outreach. To better understand these questions, ITRC surveyed existing state programs, you might recall that survey, to determine what makes these programs effective and what issues affect the durability of the institutional controls. The survey was submitted to ITRC representatives for all 50 states, and 44 responses were received. Overall, the survey responses have been used to identify which elements help maintain or create a more effective long-term institutional control program. As shown on this slide, this guidance focuses on ICs already in place rather than on the details of selecting institutional controls. That will be in the 2008 guidance document. Properly selecting and implementing institutional controls, however, is essential for that long-term durability and effectiveness. Therefore, this guidance provides a summary of some of the key components that are considered when choosing an institutional control. Now, during this presentation and in our guidance document, you'll see this diagram which illustrates the five essential elements of the institutional control life cycle. Beneath the elements of the life cycle, we list the critical components that must be considered to achieve a successful management program. These essential elements and the components essentially form the structure of our guidance document, and the various sections or chapters in the guidance document address each of these elements in more detail. Together, these create an effective long-term stewardship program that we hope you will look to review and hopefully implement in your state. As the presenters transition between each element, you'll see this figure reappear on the screen, and they will specifically highlight the arrow of the topic that we will be discussing. Now, this guidance document is relevant to environmental regulators at all levels of government, also private and public responsible or obligated parties, current site owners and operators, environmental consultants, prospective purchasers of property, and real estate agents. Additionally, stakeholders who have an interest in a property will find this guidance helpful in understanding the elements required to manage institutional controls as well. This guidance document assists those who are responsible for the stewardship of institutional controls by describing the critical elements and even the best practices for IC management. Now, much of this document is based on the successes and lessons learned from established state and federal agency programs. So our recommendations and case studies come right from you, the audience. Now, as part of the guidance document, ITRC has also developed a downloadable tool that can help create a long-term stewardship plan that can be tailored for specific sites. This tool incorporates the various institutional control management practices that are presented here today in the early stages of site-specific IC planning. Now, we talked about at the beginning of the presentation there was a poll question, and we'll get into the poll results later, but I wanted to bring forth an example from my state about how institutional controls can fail. In this case, a prospective purchaser of property was conducting their due diligence prior to purchasing the property. The property was in the location of a former leaking underground storage tank that was closed in 1997 with institutional controls in the form of a deed restriction, which included within it a groundwater use restriction and that the requirement that the property retain its commercial zoning. During the due diligence efforts, the prospective purchaser found that the property had been split into two parcels, one parcel now being zoned as residential with a home built and a new drinking water well installed in 2001, clearly against everything that was written in the deed restriction. These circumstances went undetected by the regulatory agency until 2015, when a prospective purchaser called the agency asking about the closure and the land use restrictions concerning the well. Subsequent investigatory work was conducted and fortunately determined that the new residence and the drinking water well were side gradient of the contaminated groundwater plume, and that the violations of land use restrictions did not result in a long-term 10 or more year exposure to groundwater contamination. But the breach of the institutional control had occurred a mere 4 years after the placement of the restrictions on the groundwater and land use. This should have been well within the institutional knowledge that can be reasonably expected of agency staff. With land use and permitting agencies operating as separate entities from the regulatory agency, the unfortunate lack of an outreach program and monitoring program led to confusion and ultimately the permitting of a drinking water well permit, a zoning change, split parcels with different addresses and parcel IDs from that original parcel that contained the restrictions. Presumably, an outreach program aimed at local health departments, which is the water well permitting agency, the local health department would likely have known of the contaminated groundwater in the area and would have likely been better informed of the groundwater use restrictions. In recent years, the regulatory agency has taken that lessons learned and implemented a local health department outreach program to discuss the use of an online environmental mapper and database, which is where the agency places its fully recorded or fully implemented institutional control on a publicly accessible database to ensure that they, the local health department, have all the information to fully evaluate drinking water well applications and to assist them in making good and protective permitting decisions. The agency is also undertaking pilot projects to address the monitoring aspect of institutional controls. The regulatory agency does not have a formal monitoring program in place, but they're taking steps to, you know, do a pilot project and see how the instruments are being complied with. So we just heard about one state example of why institutional controls fail, but what are the other examples? And Juliana has graciously presented the results from the initial poll question that was at the beginning of our presentation. And the results have been pretty identical to numerous other ITRC presentations where the top three vote getters is that monitoring is inadequate, communication of the institutional control details were inadequate, and potentially that the institutional control was not implemented at the site. So it might have been developed, but we haven't gotten to the finish line yet. Other issues or reasons why institutional controls may fail include a physical break of a barrier, you know, something that is observable through a drive-by monitoring program, inadequate reporting, so there might be statutory or rule requirements that require reporting of, you know, annual check-ins for the institutional control compliance, inadequate monitoring, which is what I had mentioned with my state, a violation of the land use restriction or covenant, which happened in Michigan where there was a violation of the land use restriction and permitting of the well. And finally, inadequate communication of the institutional control details. Maybe the location is not sufficiently described. So, you know, somebody would breach a cover and the cover wasn't adequately defined on some sort of site figure, diagram, or survey that would run with the land in institutional control. So there's many reasons why institutional controls fail, but we're hoping to, you know, present with our guidance document that we can suggest or recommend some practices that will help strengthen your state or federal or even as a private party the way that you manage your sites to prevent these failures from happening. Now, what makes institutional control failure a significant issue is the potential for exposure grows as more institutional controls are used and not properly managed. It could be a slippery slope. To illustrate the universe of institutional controls across the nation, this map indicates that 60% of states that responded to our survey stated that they have over 200 institutional controls in place in their states. But what we've seen is that programs to manage institutional controls can vary greatly, and some states may not have that formal management program at all. There are solutions to prevent failures of institutional controls, which is presented in ITRC's new guidance document and discussed in today's presentation. An institutional control can only remain effective so long as it continues to be recognized, respected, and upheld by the affected stakeholders. Not only does the awareness of a new institutional control need to be communicated to potentially the affected community, but this awareness should be maintained throughout the entire life of the institutional control, not just when it's put in place and immediately thereafter. Stakeholder outreach discussed later in the presentation includes identifying and involving internal and external stakeholders throughout the IC lifecycle. In addition to the guidance, ITRC went one step farther and developed a downloadable tool that takes users through the process of planning and designing institutional control management needs. This tool can help create a long-lasting record of the site that includes the regulatory authorities, details of the institutional control, the responsibilities of all parties, a schedule for monitoring of the performance of the institutional control, and much more. Now, the tool generates an editable long-term stewardship plan, which comes out through Microsoft Word. Now, if you're a consultant or a regulated entity who's closing sites with long-term monitoring, or, you know, some sort of other agency regulator, you'll really want to stay tuned to near the end of today's session, where we will provide a brief tutorial and demonstration on this downloadable tool. Now, up next is Doug Birch, an industry representative from Ramboll Environ, who will briefly discuss the planning and implementation part of the institutional control and then dive further into stakeholder outreach.
Oh, there we go. Thanks, Kevin. And I appreciate everyone who's joined our call. As shown here on our ever-present life cycle diagram of an IC, the first elements of an IC are planning and implementation. Now, our guidance document assumes planning and implementation has already been completed and the sites move to the next stage, which is long-term management of those institutional controls. We as a group realize there's no need to reinvent the wheel. There's already guidance and very good guidance on planning and implementation available from US EPA, ITRC, and others. And I've used this guidance, and it's very helpful at sites. I've used it most recently on a site in Nebraska. However, where we've found that it tends to fall short is it regarding the long-term management of those ICs. So first, I want to provide a brief summary of planning and implementation, though, since they are key elements to an IC, and then I'll launch into stakeholder outreach and communication. So the first component or element is planning. Be sure you understand your site thoroughly. Be sure you assess your parameters of concern, their distribution, the media that's impacted, the potential exposure pathways or complete exposure pathways. What's the current land use? What's potential future land use? Is there residential development in the future? Will someone be interested in using the groundwater in the future? Are there people nearby using groundwater? Plan for the full cost of an IC. Now remember, a IC is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are costs and responsibilities associated with an institutional control. Remember, in some places, it may even be cheaper to do some remediation to limit your IC or even eliminate it because of the long-term costs associated with that. So once you've completed the planning phase, the next phase is to implement the ICs, which includes formalizing the IC and recording it. Now, an IC is more than just a piece of paper sitting in a filing cabinet at the county recorder's office. That is just the beginning of your journey once you formalize it. Nearly half, 46% of the respondents to our ITRC survey indicated that lack of proper implementation was a reason for an IC failure. Long-term stewardship is a critical element in successfully implementing ICs. And as Kevin mentioned, as part of our guidance document, we are providing a tool for developing a long-term stewardship plan, and that will be discussed later in this training. And I strongly suggest you consider making use of our tool during the planning and implementation phase. So moving on to communication and outreach. The outreach begins with planning and implementation of an IC, but it also extends to the entire life cycle of the IC, which in many cases could be decades or could be forever. For effective outreach and communication, you must identify your stakeholders, establish and maintain communication with those stakeholders, and inform stakeholders of their roles and responsibilities. You can think of these three items as ingredients. If each is properly addressed, then in combination, they will result in successful outreach. But if you skimp on one of those ingredients, you're going to have problems. Our ITRC survey determined that 41% of IC failures were a direct result of inadequate communication. So think about that. This means that almost half of failures of ICs could have been prevented if outreach and communication with stakeholders was effective. Remember, outreach success is equal to IC success. However, outreach failure is equal to IC failure. So who or what is an IC stakeholder? A stakeholder is not limited to the owner of a specific property with an IC, but includes all affected or interested parties. This can include individuals, and it can also include groups, such as nearby property owners, tenants, regulatory agencies, the community, environmental consultants. I've got a list here, and that list goes on and on. Use a broad brush when you define who was affected. We have provided a general summary of typical stakeholders and their potential concerns in Table 5 of our guidance document. So where do stakeholders fit in? Each stakeholder in an IC has their own set of concerns as well as their own set of responsibilities to ensure continued success of an IC. Common concerns include items such as health. How is this going to affect my health or the health of others? Is this going to affect the value of my property? How can I keep the value of my property from diminishing? Is this going to be a blight on my community? Responsibilities can include items such as keeping records and reporting to a regulatory agency. I have a site in Minnesota which was closed with an institutional control, and once a year, the property owner, my client, has to send a letter to Minnesota PCA to tell them that institutional control is still there and is still effective. And remember, if an IC says don't install a well or says don't do something, then that means you don't do that. You don't install a well, and you don't allow others to install wells. For an IC to be successful and remain effective, stakeholder concerns should be addressed, and they must be aware of and understand their responsibilities. Remember, stakeholders are often a wide range of individuals and groups, and so are their concerns, responsibilities, and so are their information needs. There's many communication methods that can be used to provide information to stakeholders. Some of these communication methods may be mandated as part of the IC, and others may be voluntary and just be put in to help strengthen your IC. Two primary methods of communication that are often used in combination are direct and passive outreach. Direct outreach is also known as push. This means you're pushing information out to the stakeholders. This can include something as simple as posting a no fishing or a don't eat the fish sign. It can also be something much more sophisticated, such as including ICs and excavation clearance one call systems. Passive outreach, on the other hand, is also known as pull. That means you're making information available for stakeholders to find. This can be putting ICs on a property deed, and it can be providing information on ICs in a searchable database. I have a site in Omaha on which we put ICs and closed it, and shortly thereafter the site was sold, and the new property owner, we informed them, pushed out information to them to let them know about the ICs and their responsibilities. Fast forward a few years, and I received a phone call from that property owner, and they were planning to do some excavation work as part of a construction project, and they wanted to know, is this going to be an issue with our ICs? So they actually were pulling information from us. So I think that's a great example of push and pull working in combination successfully. Now, I mentioned searchable database. I have here a screenshot from the Missouri DNR searchable database. It's actually in the city of St. Louis near my home, and I'm probably considered a stakeholder because I'm a community member. I can drill down and find locations and information on those on ICs in my area. So providing multiple and redundant communication methods for IC stakeholders will help to ensure success of the IC over the long term. Ignorance is not bliss when it comes to ICs. So based on the results of our ITRC survey, IC outreach is a work in progress and definitely needs some improvement. And as we've discussed, uninformed stakeholders are a recipe for IC failure. Our ICI survey showed that the vast majority of outreach is focused only on current property owners, 90%. And less than half of new owners are included in outreach, as you can see here, 43%. And only 20% of tenants or adjacent landowners are included in outreach. And as we discussed earlier, there are a lot more stakeholders than just the ones shown here, and I'll guarantee you those percentages drop off quite a bit when you start talking about other stakeholders. So use robust IC outreach to inform and educate stakeholders. This means identify and provide outreach to all potential stakeholders. Be aware of and anticipate stakeholder information needs. Tailor your information to stakeholders and keep it understandable. Try not to use complicated scientific jargon. Use layman's language where you can. And ICs and communication are not necessarily static. Revisit your outreach over time and update as necessary to improve. And the IC stewardship tool, which will be described later in this presentation, can help you create and maintain successful outreach to IC stakeholders. So we've discussed the need for available, easily understood, and up-to-date records as part of stakeholder communication and outreach. And Doug Suter of GHD will next discuss IC data management and registries.
Thanks. Okay, so I'd like to start out with the basic definition of a registry, which is a centralized repository of information about institutional controls. Typically throughout an agency or throughout another type of organization. I'd like to actually start out with a poll question related to registries. And the question is, have any of you experienced or witnessed a problem or violation of an institutional control due to lack of awareness where a registry could have made a difference? So the poll results are fairly evenly split among the answers. It looks like, yes, there is a situation where a registry could have made a difference, seems to be the slight majority answer. The next slide here, this is a map which shows what state agencies have registries and whether or not those registries are for internal agency use or if they are from for public use as well. And as you can see, there's a significant number of states do not have any registry at all. And we have a couple that were had no response, but the majority do have some kind of registry, at least with agency access, and a lot of them with public access. And again, this is from the survey. These are the causes of institutional failure. And as the initial survey or poll indicated, inadequate monitoring is by far the most common failure of institutional controls. Inadequate communication falls next, and location not sufficiently described falls outwards. And all of these can be fixed with a registry, which would allow you to schedule things to prevent inadequate monitoring. They would improve communication efforts, and they would allow for location information for institutional controls. Start first about the agency use of a registry. The agency can use the registry within the different divisions, can have a common registry. They can manage outreach to stakeholders. They can keep track of enforcement information. They can include compliance information. They can use it as a document repository. They can track reporting obligations. There are a lot of different uses within the agency that these repositories can provide. This is essentially a database of all the information related to the institutional control. And this is building on the Missouri example. So this is a typical internal view of what would be in a registry. And as you can see on the tabs across the top, you can see that they do provide summary information, but they have lists of the contaminants that are involved, the media, whether it's soil or groundwater or air, the remediation objectives, the instruments. In this case, the instrument means, is it a deed restriction, is it a covenant, or what the type of institutional control it is. They also have a tab for contacts, so you can provide information about the owner of the property, about stakeholders, about agency personnel involved in the property. The next tab is activities monitoring, and so you can actually include records of all the periodic monitoring that's been done, any additional activities, if there's records of repair of a breached engineered barrier, and then an inspection to show that it's fine. And then the last tab is a collection of reports, and they'll actually have, you know, PDF copies of different reports associated with this particular property. So then we get to some of the public uses of a registry. The public use of the registry is, of course, more restrictive than the inside agency use. You probably wouldn't have much in the enforcement correspondence in the public use. But the public use is very valuable for property owners who want to take a look at nearby properties to determine if they would be a stakeholder and if they have concerns. Also, if there's an institution control on their own property, and additional buyers and developers, you know, this is one of the things that you would want to do in a phase one environmental site assessment, is be able to find an institutional control. And a registry can really help out with that effort. Developers, again, need to work within the terms of an institutional control. If there is a big concrete slab that's used as an engineered barrier and there's an institutional control that says that has to be maintained, the developer needs to work around that limitation. Construction and utility workers, this is a number of the registries actually tie in with the 811 calls or one call systems. And if a utility and construction workers go out to a site and they're going to dig a hole, it's very important for them to know that they're going to come across any kind of contamination or other circumstances that could cause injury. You know, maybe there's free product gasoline and it could actually cause a fire or explosion. And I will go to the next. This is the public page of the Missouri DNR again, used as an example. And in this case, it allows you to locate different sites geographically. In other words, you don't have to have the US EPA ID number for a facility to find it. And you don't have to navigate through a maze of obtuse identifiers and citations. You can actually just go on a map, zoom into an area you're interested in, click on some of these little pin locators, and get additional information from the site. So the development of a registry, the first thing you need to do is do a complete inventory of the institutional controls. Now, when you first develop a registry, what you'll be working with is a bunch of individual project files and internal spreadsheets and lists and incomplete databases and a couple of boxes of old paper that are in the back room. And it's going to be a tremendous effort to get all of this stuff organized into a registry, electronically transcribed and checked and verified. You'll need to decide what kind of key attributes do you want to include. Do you want to use parcel identification numbers? Do you want to use site identifiers? It depends on the circumstance what the key attributes you want to use. You do need to decide what information will be available for internal use and what information is available to the public. And then once you've had all this information into a database, including the geographic information that shows the boundaries of the different features, you're not done at that point. You've got to do frequent verification of accuracy. Which brings us to the next topic, which is maintenance of a registry. And maintaining and updating a registry is a key part of the system. You can't just put it in and expect it to be good forever. There are going to be errors and omissions that come up periodically that will need to be fixed. There will be updates to parcel identifiers based on, you know, county level maps. There will be new versions of Internet Explorer and Chrome and Opera and the different browsers. There will be, you know, new versions of underlying databases and geographic information systems. And all of these need to be managed. And specifically, you need to have a fairly robust and ongoing budget to include all of these different issues. And then I'm going to one last section. This is a zoom in of the previous map that we looked at, the PIN map. And this just gives some of the information that's available to the public. And you can see that there are actually these bounding boxes which show the limits of the particular institutional control. And so you have this South Pier site. It's got a little box, and then you can click the little link to provide more information about what is permitted and what is not permitted to comply with the institutional control. And so that ends this section, and then the next section is actually, we're going to talk about a question and answer session first.
Thanks, Doug. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. And if you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute.
Hi, Juliana. It's Lynn.
Perfect. Thank you so much for the extra work to get on the line. We appreciate it.
Sorry for the hassle.
No problem at all. So for our participants, if you are on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to jump in with a question. We'll start with a question that's come in. What are your experiences with IC communication via realtors during property sales?
Well, realtors, part of the process of selling or exchanging properties, so they are a stakeholder. You have to be aware of the role that they play and the other roles that other stakeholders play. So they're not the be-all, end-all, but I certainly would want to include them as a stakeholder.
Yeah, this is Doug Suter. One of the things is that the a good industrial, commercial, real estate agent will actually know a lot of the issues with different sites just from their familiarity with the area. Residential realtors will probably know nothing.
Mm-hmm. What is the estimated cost for developing an IC registry?
This is Mike Sawinski. I'll just chime in for starters. I mean, that's a little bit of a tough question because for one, at least, I don't know that there's a lot of data on that, but also when states develop their IC registries, they often tend to do it in combination with a larger environmental data system that keeps track of all the environmental site information. So it's a little bit hard to piece it. Having said that, I have worked with some states, and I can tell you roughly that states who have done it internally or have outsourced it, their kind of upfront costs might range anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 to get it up and running. I'm sure some states have spent more than that. I'm just talking about a couple that I've seen. And then there's sort of an ongoing cost usually of keeping the site running and up to date.
Yeah, and that $50,000 to $100,000 is really just the IT charges. That doesn't include all the legwork to actually get all the information into the registry. And that, of course, depends on what your current systems are.
What have been your all's experience with the penalties, the fines associated with ITRC failures? Who's been paying? Is it the prior owner or the new owner in the example of a property transaction years prior to failure?
That usually depends on the transaction agreement. And generally in a simple land transfer, that the obligations would pass to the new property owner, and the new property owner would therefore be responsible for any breaches and penalties. There are, you know, some cases where there is a terms in the agreement where the original landowner does continue to have environmental obligations, but that is all set out in the property transaction agreement itself.
And this is Mike Squinchy. I'll just add to that. Unfortunately, there's not a, and we're going to talk about enforcement. There's not a ton of enforcement actions that have actually issued penalties. So the data set to answer that question is really not that strong. Having said that, like many of you would guess, as a legal matter, usually there's an avenue to the new owner and the old owner, and just it kind of going to depend on cynically, who has the most money or, you know, the preferences of the enforcement agency.
Yeah, and you also have the potential for just tort lawsuits. Someone gets sick, they blame the contamination, and then in that case, both the buyer and the seller would both be unhappy with the what would then transpire.
What is the longest record of a successful IC in the U.S.?
I'm not sure of the actual years. I know ICs have not been around. You know, they're part of the risk-based closure, which is, you know, a decade, few decades old, no older than that. So, you know, the time frame is not too long since those have started, I think, to roll out. Correct me if I'm wrong, everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you could maybe pin it down to Love Canal as one of the starting. You know, Love Canal was a, you know, the Superfund site number one, and it started out with an old canal that had been used for waste disposal, which they had incorporated into the property deed a prohibition against ever digging into the soil, which didn't turn out that well.
Right. That is true, but and that is probably one of the first known ICs, but I think the question was about successful, and that's probably – the Love Canal is kind of the poster child, right, for the most unsuccessful IC probably ever. but I think probably about 20 years when ICs first started coming up. I mean, many of them have been successful. So from the beginning, it's been roughly about 20 years since some have been in operation.
And Shannon Schmidt, who is also part of this team, says that she knows of an IC on record in Minnesota that is from 1989.
What's that? Oh, great. Yeah, that sounds right. 27 years, 20 years.
So we've seen some examples from that Missouri IC registry. And is that just limited to Missouri, or is that available in other places?
We actually chose Missouri as an example. Different states have completely different setups for registries, and we wanted something that would be, you know, for instance, California has one that's pretty much too complex to show in a couple of slides. Missouri's was a pretty simple and effective setup, and so we thought it was a good example rather than being specifically typical.
What happens with sites on IC registries after they've been remediated?
I can speak to Illinois. You know, under Illinois, when you have an institutional control and you go out and do further remediation, then the institutional control is then removed from the property deed with the permission of the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency.
Thank you. We have a few more questions, and I know at least one of those we're going to get to in the second half of the training class. So let's go ahead on with the second half. In some cases, our trainers will respond to questions right back to you in that Q&A pod, and we'll get to, I hope, another question and answer break at the end of the training class today. So everyone is welcome to continue to send in questions, and we'll answer those either online or at the end of the training class. I'd also like to remind you, if you do leave before we wrap up today, we do want your feedback. We really do use the feedback you provide. We're developing new courses, and the information that you provide here is going to help us not only improve this training course, but also make new courses better meet your needs. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So if a certificate is something that you would find useful, be sure to fill out the feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, and submit again, because the only way to get that certificate created is by you checking the box at the bottom of the feedback and submitting the feedback form. We'll continue on with the next section of the training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Michael Sawinski at Teradex.
Thank you. And let me get started with my pointer here. Okay. So I'm talking about the monitoring and performance evaluation section, which, as you already know, is based on the survey that everybody here answered in the beginning, is a critical component of IC management, and it's been cited as the biggest issue for IC management. And that's, you know, because it's just not a perfect world. If monitoring and performance evaluation works on top of the important topics that we already went through, data management, the registry, and stakeholder outreach, and if life was perfect, those things would work in a way where the world would automatically comply perfectly with every single institutional control. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And so monitoring and performance evaluation becomes a critical element. So here, what I'm going to talk about is the common methods and best practices for IC monitoring and performance evaluation, because, like we know, it matters. And first, just to sort of clarify a couple of terms, in the ITRC guidance document, and perhaps we were splitting hairs, but we just divided the two concepts of monitoring and performance evaluation, and where monitoring was referring to the collection of information at institutional control sites, and then performance evaluation referred to, you know, the process of making decisions or reaching conclusions based on that data that was found. So more specifically, because I've confused and I've understandably confused people in the past, let me just talk about what is IC monitoring, if it's not already intuitive. And to do that, let me start by going back to institutional controls a little bit and remind all of us that regardless of the type of institutional control, which we didn't talk a ton yet, I know Kevin talked to some extent, but you know, institutional controls range from different types of recorded deed restrictions to government controls, et cetera. But regardless, what's in common with them is that they list things that generally should not happen at a property because of the environmental contamination, like there shouldn't be groundwater use, there shouldn't be any type or maybe limited types of excavation, maybe there shouldn't be no residential use or schools or daycare, et cetera. So IC monitoring refers to the collection of data and information, observations about uses at the activity where the IC exists, to learn whether any of these things that shouldn't happen are happening or are properly not happening. So we're looking at the uses to learn that the activity about activities that might violate the IC requirements. And so it's not conventional monitoring. So I'm not talking about taking soil samples or drilling wells and collecting groundwater samples. It's a different type of institutional control monitoring. Which leads to the question, well, what types of institutional control monitoring are out there? How do they work? What are states doing? What are their advantages and disadvantages? And so there's six categories of approaches that I'm going to talk through. Agency inspections, obligated party inspections, excavation monitoring would be one call. You've heard some talk about this already. A broader set of land activity monitoring, local government coordination, and IC permit programs. With that very brief introduction, and since I think many of you probably already know a lot about those activities already, which of the following do you utilize or do you know of that are utilized for IC monitoring? State agency inspections or obligated party, meaning current owner or perhaps prior owner, inspections, one call, some type of land activity monitoring, like monitoring for new water wells being installed, monitoring for new building permits, monitoring for new land developments, some coordination with local government, or some sort of IC permit program. So as I'm seeing the results come in, and you're seeing this too, the trend that you're seeing with the 60%, 50% up here in the state agency inspections, and then a lower number of respondents on the other categories is typical of what we found during the writing of the report and what we found since then. And the bottom line is, which I'll talk about, is these inspection approaches, or maybe annual or biannual inspections, are the more conventional way to monitor land and are still the most popular, but the other approaches are more tailored, more frequent, and are growing in popularity. Let me move on to the next slide, Juliana, thanks. trying to forward here. Okay, there we go. All right, so I'm going to talk for just a minute or two about each of the approaches. Some of them are more straightforward than others. So approach number one, and I number these myself, so there's no particular reason for the ordering. Approach number one are state agency inspections, and it's, you know, fairly an intuitive process where the state agencies are running the show. They're setting an inspection schedule that they manage themselves, and oftentimes they create a standard form for internal staff to use. After doing some homework about what the ICs are at the site, the agency staff visits the site and just basically looks at what's occurring compared to what the institutional control requirements are, makes findings, and then records those findings typically internally. And in a couple states, there are even public websites that have copies of the inspection reports there for viewing. So those inspection reports are saved, like I said, either privately at the state agency or publicly. And some states have some nifty forms that pre-populate with databases and things like that that bring some efficiencies. But the general gist is, you know, what's required there, let's go to the site and check it out. And approach number two, which is actually very similar, but instead of the state going, you know, we're going to go out there ourselves every year, the approach relies on the obligated party. By the way, the obligated party is a term we use in the guidance document to refer to whichever person might be the responsible for the institutional control at the site, because we recognize that it could be the current owner. In some cases, it could be the prior owner, and rather get all convoluted than that, collectively refer to the party as the obligated party for the sake of our document. But these obligated party inspections are ordinarily set within the recorded covenant. So the institutional control itself will say something like the obligated party or the current owner must inspect once a year and send some sort of certification to the agency. Some states, like Kansas, provide a form that the obligated party needs to use to, you know, keep things standardized. But not all states create forms. And some states prefer not to based on the, you know, unique nature of all the sites. When the process is still has some agency involvement, even though the burden is on the obligated party, because the agency still has to keep track of who did and did not send in their annual report, and they typically send reminder letters to make sure people are going forward with this. They track the receipt of the inspections and certifications, and then if they don't get it, that can often serve as a trigger for the agency to maybe go out there themselves or to otherwise do some additional compliance-related look. So that is approach number two. Now, final approach has become, I guess I'd say, less conventional, you know, because, you know, an inspecting a site is I think, a fairly conventional approach. But the use of the one call to monitor excavations at a property is a popular and growing trend. That approach relies on the connection of the site boundaries into the 811 system at the state. Based on the 811 system collecting excavation information and providing it back to the person managing the environmental activities. An email or advisory can be sent to warn the excavator to say, hey, you sent a ticket in to do an excavation, but there's actually an environmental, you know, restriction there. And this approach is ordinarily, not always, but often leverages a third-party intermediary. So states hire companies to help make this work efficiently at the state level. And I just back up just for a second on this one, because it tends to raise questions, and just explain kind of how it all evolves. The 811 centers exist across the country for other reasons. They've been there regardless of environmental contamination for the purpose of protecting people from excavating into underground lines, you know, not blowing up gas pipes, not digging into water lines, electricity lines, etc. So those types of underground facility owners must join the one call center. And then excavators, and this is all by state law in every state, excavators must call the one call center before they excavate. And the one call center then looks at the excavation compared to the members who have joined and told them about where their lines are. And if there's an overlap, they notify the underground facility owner who then goes out and marks the line. And then the person excavating is the person who excavates. When they get out there to excavate, they know where not to excavate because they know where the lines are. In the environmental space, we just leverage this process and use it just slightly differently. Instead of submitting an underground line to the A101 Center, we submit boundaries of the cleanup site. And again, usually with the help of a third party to negotiate the technical nuances and somewhat of a square peg round hole issues, because the A101 Centers were built for originally for different purposes. But then when an excavation happens at a cleanup site, then instead of someone going out to the site and spray painting the boundaries of the cleanup site and an email or a fax or a text advisory is sent to the excavator explaining to them that this is an advisory, that this is an environmental site and there might be some issues here. So this is one, I know it's not super readable, but this is one example of in Delaware where the Department of Natural Resource uses this one call system at thousands of sites. And every time there's an overlap like this, an advisory goes out with contact information from the agency and some description of where the excavation is in comparison to the site and other details of, so that the excavator can dig deeper or call someone if they feel like what's on this one-page set of information isn't enough for them to move forward with. Now, I noticed somebody asked whether agencies can ever be liable for, some kind of violation at an institutional control site when they're managing this process. So I'll just answer it now. The short answer is no. I mean, there's all kinds of statutes that protect agencies in general whenever they're basically, doing their agency job. And maybe there's arguably some exceptions. If some agency did something horribly, horribly wrong, they could possibly be liable for if an IC didn't go correctly. But generally speaking, they can't be. We can talk more about that in future Q&As, but that's the short answer on that. Let me move on to the approach number four, which is I lost my little guy here. Okay. Land use and activity monitoring. So this is, in some ways, like one-call monitoring, but different. I just had this conversation with someone yesterday who was going, I get this whole one-call thing, but what other types of land activity monitoring happen? And because maybe excavation is not as relevant for us. So in the broader land activity monitoring space, there are, this is also a third-party intermediary thing, typically. There are private services that can monitor through electronic means, FOIA and so forth, on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, all the things that happen at property and that there's an electronic or paper trail for. And so unless it's an illegal activity, there's some sort of record out there about somebody applying for a building permit or going to a zoning board hearing to build a shopping center next door or otherwise to do a subdivision or develop or whatever, or to drill a water well, or to listing properties for sale, or actually selling properties or building schools. All those things are, and there's more, all those things are out there as data sources that if they're relevant to the IT monitoring question, they can be handled under this land use and activity monitoring approach, which about, according to our surveys, and I also know this just from personal knowledge, about 9 states use. And it works, from a workflow, it's similar to excavation in the sense that, there's a boundary that's targeted, there's a review of things happening at the site, and if some of those things overlap with the boundaries, then some sort of fax, email, or text message can be sent to whoever is on the list of people, and that can be set up anyway. Any stakeholders can be on the list. It's just a flexible process. Can get email alerts and so forth about the issue. So approach number five has involved states and local governments figuring out how to work together to monitor institutional controls. And there's really the different ways for agencies to cooperate, you know, are many. So these are the three ways that we wrote about in our document and that I've personally seen as well. Well, on one hand, you know, the sort of minimum coordination is when a state agency simply informs the local government as to the location of their IC. So it could be as simple as going, we have this great registry, local government, make sure you look at it and know what's going on in your jurisdiction so you can act accordingly. That's like, you know, some people might call that a push approach. I don't know, but that's at least the state informing the local government as to what's going on. But more involved coordination are when the local government and the state are kind of going back and forth, or even the local government is really taking over institution of control monitoring. So this eyes and ears approach is when the local government is informing the state agency or the federal agency about all the things that are going on with permits and so forth at the areas and that the state has ICs at. Or, you know, in some cases, particularly in cases where, you know, big Superfund sites, for example, when a whole jurisdiction, a whole city might be impacted by, say, lead contamination or some contamination that results in an institutional control being there. Sometimes the local government might kind of take over and enact a whole set of ordinances and manage the whole set of ordinances to protect the institutional control. Let me just give you a couple quick examples. This is an example of Delaware using what I've called the eyes and ears, I'm sorry, of Colorado using the eyes and ears approach. And there, the state, you know, they have their tracking system and their registry, so they're able to, you know, easily publish out GIS information or shape files, if you will, about the IC locations. And then in the case of Denver, so if they're a sophisticated city, they're able to just accept that same GIS set of information. This data flow could be paper-based, but in this case, it works via GIS. And then once Denver then knows, you know, where the different spots are in the city that have institutional controls as defined by the state, and what the city can do is make, and what they do is make a list every week of the different permits that have been applied for or finalized or whatever, you know, in progress, issued, finalized, and send that list to the state, and which basically says at your institutional control site, these are the different types of permits that people have applied for, so that the state can be apprised of that monitoring information and assess whether any of those permits are potentially an issue with the institutional control. That's an eyes and ears approach. So eyes and ears mean the government's not, local government's not, you know, assuring compliance. They're just providing the state agency with the information it could use to help assure compliance. And the other end of the spectrum is, like I said, in the Superfund site situation, this is the Jasper County example, where the city just, you know, issued its own ordinance that's called an institutional control ordinance, and it's all about, in this case, protecting from excavation or building that goes beneath, I think it's like 6 inches or 12 inches or something, because the remediation across a very large part of the town is protected down to a certain depth, but below a certain depth, there's still lead in the soil that could be dangerous. And finally, this approach number six is really at this point only used in New Jersey, but other states are expressing interest, so we thought it was worth raising up here in this report, and that's an IC permit, which one way of thinking of it is a formalized or glorified approach of the obligated party inspection and certification. So instead of you know, requiring on a one-off basis that the obligated parties inspect and certify their institutional control, in New Jersey, whenever there's a groundwater or soil institutional control required, there's what they call a remedial action permit required, and I'm calling it an IC permit, because what it essentially does is it requires the monitoring of the site so that the state can be assured that the anything required by the institution of control, groundwater soil IC, is in fact, you know, being complied with. And these reports are, there's a permit, that instead of just a looser requirement. There's an actual formal permit requiring that to happen, and there's a fee charge and assessed, I think, every 2 years. It could be every year. I apologize and forget the moment. To help formalize, almost like you would get a permit for discharging water or discharging air. In this case, yeah, there's a permit required when you have an IC at your site. And in some cases, when there's also an engineering control, in addition to the engineering control, then there's an added level of financial assurance so that the state can know that whoever's the obligated party is can have money in place if the institutional control needs to be repaired or otherwise fails. So those are the six approaches. I think the logical question goes, well, who's doing what across the state? And what our surveys have shown is that states are typically using one to all five approaches in combination. So you kind of already saw this in the surveys where the approach of the state agency or maybe the state agency combined with obligated party inspections is the most common. But what states are doing is also doing excavation monitoring, also doing land activity monitoring, often in combination, because what they find happens is by bringing some of these more tailored and frequent approaches where they're keeping an eye on the land activity, you know, through these services, their need for inspections maybe reduces or they otherwise get, you know, better insights into what's going on at the site. So they tend to combine the approaches and also in some cases they might go, well, at these 50 sites we think inspecting once a year is fine, but at these 100 sites we feel like maybe a little bit more is needed. So you see those types of patterns developing. Speaking of patterns, I'll just give you a snapshot of at least when we developed the report, so this is now made, you know, a few months old, but I think still accurate, of how different states are deciding to move forward, or at least the states that they're currently in their evolution of institutional control monitoring. So in Pennsylvania, which is, like I said, a very common approach, they're relying primarily on landowner certification and state agency inspections. And just as a sidebar, Pennsylvania has a particularly good way of a tiered approach to demand different landowner certifications either on a routine basis or on an event-triggered basis that helps these certifications come to them at the times that they think are the most important. Colorado, as you saw, well, as you partially saw, has this coordination with local government approach, and they also rely on inspections. Other states, and there's more, but like Idaho, smaller state, and like California, a bigger state, are combining these conventional approaches with the one call and the land activity monitoring to get, to get a better and more frequent sense of land activity at either, in Idaho's case, it's all of their sites. In California, it's a subset of the sites where they felt like it was most important to get this more frequent set of information. Which leads me to this final assessment of IC monitoring approaches before I talk just for a couple minutes about cost and then wrap up. And that's just, what's the pros and, you know, how do you know or how do you think about these different approaches as far as what the strength and weaknesses? And some of this may be intuitive, but the inspection approaches, whether they're state or owner, they're a snapshot. So whether it's once a year or in some cases once every 5 years, you get what you get at the time, and anything that happens in between, you don't know about until the next snapshot. So that's probably their largest weakness. But on the other hand, when the snapshot is taken, it's a comprehensive look and going out and actually viewing a site and the institutional control status of the site is, you know, a very powerful way. But there's resources required for that, and sometimes, you know, doing an on-site inspection and the related homework takes a lot of time. And even in the case of owner certifications, there's still a role and a burden that the agency has to meet to keep track of everything. Excavation monitoring has strength because it's nearly every day, and it's comprehensive, but only with respect to excavation. So other things happen at properties other than digging, but it is comprehensive on that in that sense. And when ICs are largely related to soil issues, it can be very powerful, but it does usually involve some third-party services, and there's some costs associated with that, which is basically a similar set of pros and cons for land activity monitoring. Very powerful stuff, really good insight into what's going on at the IC-affected property. But it's typically not something that's easy for states to spin up by themselves. So they usually tend to outsource some of that. Coordination with local government is something that doesn't necessarily require a ton of technology or third-party support, and it can be very powerful if you can get the local and states working together, like I showed in the case of Denver. And then I think the only con is that there's so much inertia, at least I've seen over the years, that acts as a barrier between a state and local government to actually figure, to actually organize an approach and the legal backbone for the approach that works. In the case of Colorado, I didn't say this earlier, but they developed a memorandum of understanding between the two agencies that took a little while for them to write it up, and it wasn't a trivial effort. It was over a year of writing and negotiating before they can get that approach in place. And then the IC permit has some good strengths in the sense that it formalizes these good approaches and brings some revenue in the form of fees to the state, but it still has some of the weaknesses of being a periodic, relying on a periodic snapshot. And you know, this is in our documents. I'll leave most of the discussion to that. But it's the idea here is that, you know, when you're looking, and I mentioned California earlier, looking at the portfolio of sites, or if you're a private party and you have one or maybe lots of sites, you're going, which method should we do when? It sort of comes down to looking at the gravity of risks based that the institutional control is protecting. Some institutional controls protect against a small risk, and some institutional control protects against very big risk, and they're all kind of different. So it's like potential for harm, potential for breach, and then you can help figure out what the best approach is. You know, when you start getting in this area is where these more tailored approaches seem to be more attractive. Okay, so then, you know, I said at the outset, you get all this monitoring data in, and then what do you do with it? Here, the document talks about evaluating the performance. So this can be done on an annual basis, or if you're doing a monitoring approach that's coming with data every day, it could even be done at a lighter level all the time. But you're essentially, you know, you block yourself into these choices. ICs are working fine. There's some compliance issues that are minor. Maybe some reports are late, but there's no major problems. Maybe the monitoring program that isn't actually addressing the site properly, and that's actually something that the on-site inspections are very good at figuring out. Or maybe we don't need an IC anymore, so we can terminate it. Or there's actually things happening at the property that the IC says shouldn't happen, and we need to start thinking about enforcement, which is a topic that Kevin's going to be addressing shortly. So in the guidance document, one of the best practices that we saw states, including Idaho, as an example off the top of my head, moving forward on is developing a policy or guidance that captures everything I just talked about. Because this whole process of monitoring institutional controls is a relatively new thing. And so states are still scratching their heads a little bit, figuring out what sites should be done with what approach. So putting a guidance together and expressing the different criteria that impact how to monitor sites is a good practice, and it brings everything into focus as for the case of Idaho. Quickly, everybody always asks, well, this monitoring is great, but how do I pay for it all? And so there are some answers to that, but it also is an evolving question. So there's two pieces of relevant information that I will leave you with. One is that SWAMO has provided some help, and they help figure out what things cost in the first place. Because, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is to go, well, it takes my guy, you know, 8 hours of prep and 6 hours of field time to go to an institutional control site and do an inspection, so I'm going to, you know, take those hours and then do his hourly rate. That's my cost. But really, what Swamo points out is that there's a lot more. When you look at the IC lifecycle, when you look at all the administrative activities that need to happen from planning all the way through, these are their categories, but they largely align with our reports. All these lifecycle things take a lot of effort and burden, and therefore cost imposed upon the agency. So this resource, which I'll leave for now, provides a sort of cost estimating model. And then there's a number of examples that the report discusses in more detail about how states have actually, through regulation or less formal means, are collecting fees that divide into two categories: an upfront fee, sort of a one-time fee, in this case, $5,000 to $15,000. I can tell you that they're doing $15,000 because even that's not enough for the state's cost of administering the IC. And the second approach is an ongoing fee. This is a California, and New Jersey is also an example of this, where in California, in the covenant itself, there's language in all the covenants where the owner is agreeing to pay the department's costs. As a practical matter, what that means is you get a bill every so often that says, you know, the agency expended X, Y, and Z costs to administer the institutional control at your site, and this is something they've agreed to at the outset, and then, so they can fund their program that way. So with that, I will turn it over to Kevin, who can pick up where monitoring leaves off, and that's at the enforcement section.
Thanks, Mike. I know that monitoring has been a key component of the IC lifecycle that a lot of states have indicated as something that needs to be improved or is lacking, as our poll results have shown previously. And as I had mentioned, you know, a case study for Michigan has encountered and to go along with what we're doing here in our state, you know, we've developed that pilot project, and we used the Kansas example of an agency form to perform site reviews and property evaluations. So there's a lot of great material and a lot of examples that Mike covered that are discussed further in our guidance document. So definitely encourage everybody listening in to go to our guidance document and just start to explore what different components of the monitoring process there are and what your state's doing. And, you know, if you don't have a monitoring program in place, what one state, you know, if it's regionally close to where you are, or if it's something that you can, you know, take a bite off at the apple and move forward, definitely do that. So now let's transition to enforcement. I'm sure many of you on the phone or at your computer are geologists and engineers or other technical staff that focus on making sure all of the appropriate exposure pathways are adequately addressed and defined by the chosen institutional control. Now, as myself, a staff member who works as a liaison between our Department of Attorney General and those technical project managers, I may be contacted with the legal enforceability or enforcement of an institutional control when it comes into question and help kind of get all the site details, look at what the enforcement provisions may include, and then also network with our attorneys if necessary. So for this portion of the presentation, I'm going to highlight many of the enforcement tools contained in our ITRC guidance document that should be considered when planning, implementing, and approving the type of institutional control that's best suited for the selected remedy. Even the regulatory community will benefit from this part of the guidance, because having that understanding of the enforcement process for your state will provide an understanding of the enforcement process, how it works in your state, you know, the transparency aspect, and to be able to work through enforcement issues, you know, potential defensibility from other property owners or the regulatory agency, you know, just to be aware of what the enforcement is. That way you're not surprised when somebody comes knocking at your door with an enforcement notice. So ITRC's survey illustrates weaknesses in state monitoring and compliance efforts, you know, as Mike indicated previously in his portion of the presentation. If adequate monitoring and management requirements are not established as part of the state enforcement program, then there's going to be little to enforce. Indeed, ITRC survey results indicated that approximately two-thirds of state agencies never have taken an enforcement action against a responsible party regarding an institutional control. This is a significant statistic to keep in mind, because we do know that failures and violations do happen. Overall, the data amplifies the necessary relationship between adequate IC management tools and the foundation that they can provide to an overall meaningful institutional control enforcement program. So if Juliana could pull up the poll question, this is a simple question. Does the state you represent or where you have implemented an institutional control have an enforcement process in hand if a violation occurs, regardless of whether you've taken enforcement action? You know, are you aware of the process? All right, you can close the poll. It looks like the majority of the participants aren't sure, and then it's a half split between a yes or no with the voting. But it looks like, you know, the majority is they're not aware of an enforcement process, and that may be because there isn't one, or it might be just not used that much, or, you know, somehow buried in the regulation. So that's why our guidance document was put forth to help with that information gap. So I've previously touched upon the concepts and challenges of considering enforceability during the planning and implementation phases of institutional controls. And Mike Sawinski also covered the importance of monitoring as part of that long-term management program. In addition to these two challenges, which ITRC offers possible solutions in its guidance, identifying the proper parties to enforce the provisions of an institutional control can be both complex and complicated. And even though ICs are most commonly tied to laws that are independently administered by those state and local jurisdictions, many states may not have explicit authorities written into their respective statutes. Maybe it requires an amendment. Add into that the uniqueness of native land and federal facilities. Another challenge is that there's no current model framework to guide a compliance and enforcement strategy that is specific to institutional controls. And finally, the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act is a model statute that can be adopted into law and provide legal framework to create, modify, enforce, and terminate an institutional control, more specifically an environmental covenant. But the model language only provides for those conventional common law reliefs, such as, you know, trespass or nuisance once a violation occurs, but does not provide that compliance assistance framework that many state regulators seek to use first. ITRC's guidance document recognizes the challenges to enforcement of ICs and discusses the various legal authorities beyond that traditional statutory dependence that regulators and other parties responsible for assuring compliance may use. For example, in my state of Michigan, the laws require that restrictive covenants or deed restrictions contain a provision that grants the department the ability to enforce the restrictive covenant by legal action in a court of appropriate jurisdiction. The responsible party may also choose to write themselves into the enforcement provision, so that way they also have you know, a seat at the table to oversee their the compliance with the restrictions and the overall selected remedy that they chose into the future. Now, instruments such as consent decrees document an administrative or judicial court's approval of the settlement of an enforcement case filed in court. Typically, these consent decrees specify the actions that are to be taken or not to be taken by settling the parties. Consent decrees may have penalties attached for noncompliance, so there might be a way to utilize a settlement or judicial order to help enforce institutional controls. Now, because there is no common model legal framework for institutional controls, our guidance document suggests that the construction of the enforcement model can be premised on the traditional environmental enforcement model that's used for water, air, and waste. So when an institutional control compliance failure occurs, enforcement can be strategically applied towards the parties to return to compliance. You also want to deter any further violations and assure protection of the receptors from the threat of release or actual exposure. The ITRC guidance document suggests that voluntary compliance methods emphasize enforcement avoidance, as well as intervention to help educate a party on how to comply with the institutional control requirements. Now, in contrast, requiring involuntary compliance from a party through that formal enforcement process is generally considered a final administrative measure to resolve those violations. Failing to respond to the informal enforcement measures, violations with significant environmental impact, or parties with a history of noncompliance may generally be considered for that more formal enforcement strategy. The ITRC's guidance document emphasizes that effective enforcement of institutional control depends on thoughtful planning. Enforcement action may be considered when the IC requirements have not been observed, have not been implemented or fail to meet the requirements, have not been adequately maintained or monitored, fail to have maybe required certification, more of an administrative failure, or fail to meet those reporting requirements. Once a violation is identified through monitoring, inspection and reporting, or a performance evaluation program, the entity who can enforce can then choose either the informal or formal phase that I previously described. Well, first let's look at the toolbox. The ITRC guidance document describes the potentially available tools for your agency when seeking to choose the informal voluntary compliance assistance approach. Now, voluntary compliance actions may take many forms and will vary, of course, from state to state. Some examples that may be relatable to your state or federal agency includes informal correction letters, a request for corrective action or compliance, a deficiency letter, or an inspection report that identifies one or more issues concerning the institutional control requirements. It's a very soft approach. Materials that support an informal enforcement action can be provided to help further support the action and also to assist the obligated party in fully understanding the violation. These materials can include inspection reports, photographs, maps, and copies of relevant regulations or laws. We really want to make sure that the obligated party knows and understands what the violation is and knows and understands how to correct it and prevent anything happening similarly in the future. Now, in the event that the party fails to respond to that voluntary compliance measure, or they may fail in any requirement for corrective action within, let's say, a specified schedule, violations with significant environmental impact or those obligated parties with that history of noncompliance may generally be considered for a notice of violation without the benefit of voluntary compliance measures. Formal administrative enforcement measures may also include administrative orders, civil, judicial action, and in the most serious cases, criminal action. It's all going to be, you know, based on a case-by-case basis. What's the risks? What's the harms? What's the effort level of effort that the enforcement party wants to put forth to get the party back into compliance? So let's take a look at a case study. Now, I understand the enforcement process may be a little challenging to put all together, so the ITRC guidance document includes real-world case study examples. One such example took place in Concord, Massachusetts. Looking at the timeline, between the early 1900s and the late 1980s, a building occupied the property with light manufacturing. Between 1989 and 1990, the property assessment identified oil-stained soils with PCE and PCE-contaminated groundwater. So remedial activities were performed, but they did not satisfy unrestricted residential use. So in 1995, a notice of activity and use limitation, which is, you know, a synonym to a deed restriction environmental covenant, was recorded with the appropriate register of deeds. Now, in Massachusetts, they have within their regulations that they can audit any property for which that activity or use limitation was recorded. In May of 2012, the agency observed soil disturbance and stockpiled soil on the property. Soil samples collected a few months later and analyzed were detected to have concentrations of PCE and extractable petroleum hydrocarbons. The earth moving activities by the tenant at the site were observed without a required health and safety plan or soil management plan, which were both violations of the activity and use limitation. Massachusetts law provides for administrative penalties of up to $25,000 per day for failure to comply with the terms of an activity or use limitation. In this case, Massachusetts assessed a penalty of $5,692 and negotiated an agreement with the property owner to record an amended activity use limitation to address those violations that I described regarding the health and safety plan or soil management plan, and pay $4,000 in penalties while the rest were held in abeyance. So, you know, there is a more formal involuntary approach that the state could have used, but in this case, they assessed the level of violation and used their discretion to bring the party back into compliance. Massachusetts authorizes an administrative enforcement framework that begins with issuance of compliance assistance letters to property owners who have that notice of activity use limitation on the property deed. Failures identified through their audit program to comply with that activity use limitation is a failure to comply with the Massachusetts contingency plan, and enforcement action may be initiated, as happened in this case. In summary, planning for an institutional control enforcement action should take place at the time site-specific institutional control requirements are developed, to carefully evaluate enforceability, interested parties, jurisdictional requirements, and methods of enforcement. Plan early, plan often. Enforcement planning should occur as early as the development of the long-term stewardship plan, which Lynn Bailey from the State of Hawaii's Department of Health will now introduce.
Thank you, Kevin. Before I start talking about long-term stewardship and long-term stewardship plans, I just want to remind the audience just the differentiation in definitions. So an institutional control is defined in our team document glossary as a legal or administrative restriction on the use of or access to a site or facility to eliminate or minimize potential exposure to chemicals of concern. That's an institutional control, an IC. Now, when we talk about long-term stewardship, we're talking about what is required to ensure that the IC remains protective of human health and the environment throughout the entire life cycle of the IC. And it comes in after the IC is already in place. So why is it important to have a long-term stewardship plan? Why do we have to watch these ICs? Can't we just close the site and walk away? No, we can't. In slide 33, Doug Suter brought up the importance of making IC information available to different stakeholders, including utilities. So one issue that we've had in Hawaii, one of our bigger releases associated with the breach of an IC is what happened during an emergency utility repair. It happened in an area of one of the islands where there is known contamination, and there was an emergency utility repair. Utilities showed up to make the repair, and they had to do some dewatering. And you can see on the photos here, there is a dewatering hose coming out of the excavation, and there are some absorbent pads and some fuel inside the excavation. Well, unfortunately, as you see in the smaller picture on the lower right, there was no containment for the other end of those hoses on the opposite side of the pump. The water was allowed to drain into the storm drains. Well, in some parts of Hawaii, and particularly in this area, storm drains lead to the ocean. So this release actually came, or this breach actually came to our attention the attention of our state on-scene coordinators when somebody called in to report a release of big sheen in the harbor. Now, this was a manageable excavation project, a manageable utility project, but because at the time that this happened, there was no long-term stewardship plan in place. In Hawaii, we call them environmental hazard management plan. And because the utility was in a hurry to make the repair and they just released it to the water, it caused a much bigger issue than it could have been. Had there been a long-term stewardship plan or an environmental hazard management plan in place, and had all the appropriate stakeholders had copies of that environmental hazard management plan, this larger issue could have been avoided altogether. And we all would like to avoid these larger issues. Now, let's talk a little bit about the long-term stewardship plan itself. In spite of the importance of a long-term stewardship plan, the ITRC survey found that only 52% of responding states require some sort of long-term stewardship plan. So our team developed a template that will build a solid long-term stewardship plan and a tool that will help you create a plan of your own. The long-term stewardship plan is written after the IC is in place, and it functions much like an operations and management plan or an implementation and assurance plan. A good long-term stewardship plan will pull together the requirements of the institutional control, including any engineering control management. It's also a comprehensive guide for monitoring aspects of the ICs that Mike Sawinski discussed earlier. It should have information in there that will allow us to evaluate the effectiveness of the controls and to maintain the ICs. A good long-term stewardship plan delegates who is responsible for the different steps in monitoring, reporting, and enforcing the IC. As Doug Birch reported earlier, 41% of IC failures are related to poor outreach and communication with the stakeholders. Stakeholders need to understand the responsibilities for ICs to be effective. Our plan should make that very clear. The ultimate goal, of course, of the long-term stewardship plan is to keep the requirements of the IC in place long-term to make sure that the protection of human health and the environment is solid even when the people who initially implemented the IC are no longer part of the project. A lot of people ask, well, so who's responsible for writing it and who's responsible for keeping it? The writers and holders of the long-term stewardship plan will likely vary by state. But in general, the obligated party is responsible for writing it. However, in some instances, regulatory agencies may choose to write the plan. For instance, in Hawaii, we have written environmental hazard or long-term stewardship plans to manage old sites with historical contamination that are in public rights of way where the obligated party or the responsible party is no longer identifiable. And as far as who keeps the plan, this slide shows a small subset of people who definitely should keep a copy of the long-term stewardship plan, but a more complete list will be shown later on another slide. It should also include tenants, adjacent property owners, and even the general public, because the long-term stewardship plan should be available to the public upon request. Generally, the more people who are aware of the locations of ICs and the requirements of the ICs, the more likely we are to maintain the integrity of the IC and to protect that human health and the environment. And remember, we're thinking long term. So when we talk about writing a successful long-term stewardship plan, it sounds like, oh boy, that's going to take a lot of time. But as we mentioned earlier in the presentation, we don't want people to reinvent the wheel. In fact, please don't reinvent the wheel. All the historical information that's needed to set the stage for a successful long-term stewardship plan can be found in the site closure documents, like RODS, for example, and also the institutional control document itself. The same documents that were discussed being important for performance evaluation are the documents that we need to create the long-term stewardship plan. Some of the documents are listed here, but different states and different programs have different types of documents that can be good resources. Additionally, some ICs are interim ICs. Those are placed in sites where remediation is pending or in progress. In that case, you don't have these final decision documents to draw from, so you would pull information from finalized characterization reports like remedial investigation reports, feasibility studies, groundwater monitoring reports, as well as the interim IC. And then once the site is closed, then you would add the additional information that you gather between the interim IC and the final closure of the site. The long-term stewardship plan will build on the information that's in these documents, and then they'll tie it into the components such as monitoring, registry, outreach, and enforcement that the team discussed earlier. So we've created a theoretical site to help understand how easy it is to create a long-term stewardship plan and what types of information you'll want in your plan. This site was brought to our attention when the tenants of a casting yard northwest of the site were excavating across a pipeline easement to put in wiring for some lighting. As you can see on this aerial photograph, it's a fairly open area surrounded by industrial land. The site is small, rectangular, and it has institutional controls to observe free product, groundwater contamination, and soil contamination. For our easement site LTS plan, we got the information we needed from the historical documents we already discussed. We also pulled some of the figures from the historical documents directly into our plan, including a site plan with labeled areas of concern and IC boundaries, and contaminant figures showing delineated boundaries of the different chemicals of concern in the different types of media. We also pulled in other information from tables and texts in those other documents, including past, current, and anticipated future site use, all impacted media, sources of chemical releases, COCs, applicable screening levels, and exceedances. So slide 81 is an example of just a basic site plan. As you can see, it would have coordinates at the boundaries of the IC boundary, which is shown here as a green square. It shows the location of the original excavation as a red line. The pipelines in the easement are shown as horizontal dotted lines, and other site features are depicted as well. But the real, that just kind of sets the stage for the other figures that we'll need in our document. We need contaminant maps that show the different contamination in different media. As you can see, this is a simplified map for the presentation. Your long-term stewardship plan contaminant figures most likely will have additional details like call-out boxes or contaminant concentrations, depths of contamination, etc. Whatever valuable information is within those historical documents that will help people in the future identify where the contamination is and what type of contamination it is. For easement, our long-term stewardship plan will contain additional maps that clearly delineate the groundwater and the free product at the site. Now, since easement only has one area of concern with one type of IC, this simple type of map is sufficient. If you have a site that has multiple IC boundaries within your property, ensure that your long-term stewardship plan figures clearly show those boundaries and the contaminants within each. Now, this is a very simple site as we discussed. It's simple technically. However, the responsibility and the stakeholders make this a more complicated site than it appears on the surface. There's a pipeline easement with two separate companies responsible for the pipeline. The casting yard is run by another company that leases the site or at least this portion of the land, from a larger landowner in the area. The contamination was discovered when the casting yard crew was excavating in the easement to put in some lights. Now, if that scenario isn't complicated enough as far as the stakeholders are concerned, at the time of the discovery, the large property owner was finalizing a sale to a new landowner. Now, it's important for the long-term stewardship plan to identify all these stakeholders and to clarify which is responsible for each step of the monitoring and reporting into the future. Doug discussed how effective communication and outreach between the stakeholders can increase IC success. Table 5 of our team document lists a larger variety of stakeholders who must be considered during the life cycle of a successful institutional control. As we write the long-term stewardship plan, the roles and responsibilities of each of those stakeholders must be clearly defined throughout the remaining life cycle of the IC. Remember, we're talking monitoring, performance evaluations, enforcement, modification, and termination. Additional known and potential stakeholders from Table 5 will be included in the appendix of the plan. So when there are so many parties involved with ICs, how can we ensure that the integrity of the IC will continue to protect human health and the environment well into the future? Well, there's an app for that. The ITRC tool will assist the obligated party with writing a long-term stewardship plan that will identify monitoring requirements and clarify the responsibilities of the different parties involved. Oops, sorry, I skipped over a slide. So the long-term stewardship tool allows users to generate a word-based long-term stewardship plan, which can be further edited to smooth the language, add or delete information, or improve functionality. After generating the document, make sure that you coordinate with local regulators to ensure that the long-term stewardship plan meets all the regulatory requirements. So there is a link within our ITRC web-based document that will allow you to download a zip file that contains the tool. And we'll give you that link at the end of this section of the presentation. Within the zip file, you'll see a folder called IC_tool and a PDF document called README First. Open the README First file, and you'll see step-by-step instructions for saving and opening the tool. Now, these instructions were created based on feedback we got from earlier versions of the tool, and they're designed to help eliminate issues as you go through the use of the tool. So please, we ask that you start using the tool with this by reading this document first and following step-by-step instructions. And then later on, if you run into errors, refer back to the README file to see if you can identify the source of the error and walk through some steps to fix it. One error that we encountered as we were building the tool resulted when people ran the tool from within the zip file without extracting it. So in order to avoid that error, the README file instructs you to drag the IC tool file, that folder that you see there in this screenshot, drag that to your desktop before you open it. Okay, now you'll see a folder that's called IC Tool on your desktop. Open the folder, and you'll see a folder called Images, a folder called Templates, and an Excel file called IC Tool. Now, it's important to keep all of these files and folders together as you use the tool. Later on, you can pull things out and rename things, but as you are using the tool, changing the folder or file names or moving files or folders will hinder the tool functionality. So let's start. Click on the IC tool, the Excel tool, to open it. For many users, the tool table of contents will pop up immediately after you open the IC tool. If so, your screen will look like the next slide. Our other users may need to enable editing, enable content, and or configure Excel to trust the VBA. The README first file will show you how to do this. And you only really will have to do that the first time you use the tool on a specific device. Once those steps are complete, your screen will look like this. Also, if you close the tool and reopen it to work on it later, like if you're in the middle of writing a long-term stewardship plan and you have other things, you have to go to a meeting, you can save the file and close out of it and come back to it and click on Click Here to Get Started. And that will send you back to the form page where you left off. If you want to restart the tool completely, clicking Reset Answers clears all of the previous entries and returns you to the beginning. So this is what most people will see the first time they use the tool, whether you click here to get started or whether the tool auto-opens on the first use. Then the table when you see the table of contents, just click Next, and that will take you to the next slide. So you'll see a blank form. Notice the four buttons at the bottom. During any time in the process of answering questions and creating your long-term stewardship plan, you can return to the previous page of questions or return to the beginning by clicking on the Table of Contents button. The Next button is used to advance the tool to the next set of questions in the form. Now, any form question that's marked with a red asterisk is required, and you will not be able to click Next until the answers marked with a red asterisk are completed. As you answer the question, fill in the information appropriate to your site and write as if you were writing a document. The more complete the information is, the more robust your long-term stewardship plan will be, and the more it will read like a full document when it's done. Use the information and the decisions that are documented in the IC document and the historical documents that we discussed earlier. If there is an interim IC and remediation is ongoing or pending, use the information in that interim IC and those ongoing, the finalized feasibility studies, monitoring reports, et cetera, as we discussed earlier. In some cases, the answers you provide in one question will fill into more than one location in the long-term stewardship plan you're creating. Be careful not to use sentence fragments or abbreviations unless that's how you want it to read when you read through the document itself. If you note the red circle there, I used an abbreviation when I filled out my form. You will also be able to upload figures that will be inserted into the document. Again, choose these figures from existing site documentation. Whenever you would like to check your work, just click on the preview button on the lower right-hand corner of each page of the form. Here's an example of what you will see when you click on the preview button. It will allow you to see how your information has been filled into the form, and it will allow you to go back and make corrections within the tool if you wish. The answers you gave to questions within the tool will be highlighted wherever it auto-filled into the long-term stewardship plan you're creating. You'll notice that the highlighted text imported into the plan exactly as I wrote it into the form, including the abbreviation. Now, based on reviewer comments, if a user does not answer some of the questions in the tool, the preview will display a highlighted phrase saying, question not answered. So our easement site is technically fairly simple with just one area that has institutional controls. And this is one question that's already come up in our discussion. Somebody asked whether the tool is robust enough to handle a site with multiple ICs. And yes, it is designed for that. So if you have a site that has different conditions in different areas and you want to differentiate that, there are ways to do that. So if you have a property with different ICs in different areas, you can create a plan that will, all you have to do is you click yes for each of the additional areas you want. And you also have the option to provide a name for the areas. If you don't provide a name for each separate area, then it will just be called Area A, Area B, or Area C. And then for each of those IC areas, you will be led through a series of questions which identify which types of contamination are controlled with ICs and ECs within each area specifically. So you'll answer the questions for Area A, for instance, or in our case it was easement IC area. And say we also had a pipeline running along a ditch near the site, and we decided to call that the ditch IC area, then we would have a second set of questions that were associated with that ditch area that would identify which types of controls are in place there and how to manage them. So the long-term stewardship tool will ask questions in the monitoring section that tie back to the ICs and ECs requirements specified in earlier questions. And this section of the tool helps you choose which types of monitoring are required, who is responsible for the monitoring, and how to report the results and who to report to. After completing a section of the tool, a table like this will be included in the long-term stewardship plan for your site. Now, of course, your activity or EC that must be monitored, the frequency, the methods, and the reporting and the stakeholder responsible will all be different than what you see here on this table, and it will all be based on what you answer within the tool. So this slide actually shows how the tables are generated. When you first open a section of the tool that creates a table, you'll see column headings and one blank row. You click on a cell and select a response from a pull-down tab or type in a response. When you complete the row, click on the plus sign to add a new row and continue filling in information and adding rows until your table is complete. After all the required questions have been answered, tables have been generated, and figures have been uploaded to the tool, click on the Create Report button in the bottom right-hand corner of the last page, and a document called IC Final will be created in that folder with the templates. Feel free to save this as another name in another folder. You can edit as you would any other Word document. Edit the text, format the headings, add or delete images, spell check, etc. And in the final document, unanswered questions will show up as blanks. They will not have they will not be highlighted. Users can save the form answers and update them later, or they can reset the form to use it as a new LTS plan for another site. Just click the table of contents to return to the beginning and then close the form and click Reset Answers button. As promised, here's the link so you can download your own tool and generate your own long-term stewardship plan. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Kevin Schramm from Michigan to summarize all the information we discussed today. Kevin?
Thank you very much, Lynn. So to wrap it up, I'd like to circle back around to this diagram that you see on your screen. You know, we've presented this diagram, as I had mentioned in the introduction, throughout this presentation, and obviously the different portions from each trainer talked about the different parts of the IC life cycle. The blue arrows at the top show the critical elements of the IC life cycle. And beneath the life cycle, we listed the critical components that should be considered to achieve a successful IC management program. Failure of any of these elements can result in failure of the institutional control. These critical elements and components essentially form the structure of the guidance document, and the various sections in the guidance document address each of these elements. The guidance document also provides examples and recommendations for good stewardship practices, including the tool that Lynn presented for developing a long-term stewardship plan. I know that many people are excited about the tool that we've developed. You know, typically, you know, or in certain cases, a state agency may ask for a written formal long-term stewardship plan. And before our guidance document was put forth, there really wasn't any guidance on how to prepare a plan. So that's how I know that many people are really excited to use the tool and the guidance document. Now, as we wrap up, I'd like to ask you to think about the institutional controls where you are a stakeholder. Some of you are a state or local agency project manager, or responsible party or a consultant working on behalf of a responsible party. So just to ask yourself, how are the ICs being managed at your sites in order to ensure long-term success? When we asked the states in our survey, we found that over half the states responding do not have standard procedures in place for managing ICs across their various programs. So if you don't have a formal IC management program, you're not alone. And if you don't have programs in place to manage your ICs, how confident are you that the long-term integrity of the ICs at your sites? How do you know if they're continuing to be protective? How do you know that they continue to prevent exposure? You know, as another example, sometimes insurance companies inquire or they may inquire about institutional controls that place limits on the site use to commercial or industrial. Let's say a buyer wanted to purchase a site and redevelop it for residential use, but they didn't realize the site had an institutional control in place. The insurance company may not have placed insurance on the redevelopment unless the institutional control was modified or terminated. So it's important to track and maintain institutional controls, know what they mean, and know how to modify or terminate as appropriate. Throughout the presentation, I hope that we've drilled home the point that you can use the guidance document to help develop a long-term stewardship plan. But we also realize that you have to go back to your organizations and convince key decision makers to really invest potential time and money to put these programs into place. So we would like to encourage you to hold up our guidance document to support your cause when you're discussing these issues with those key decision makers in your organization. Use the guidance document as a credible, conscience-based tool to support your discussions with key decision makers. And remember, the ultimate goal of institutional controls is to prevent exposure to contamination that has been left in place. It's really that simple. If there's a failure of an institutional control, the risk of exposure to contamination goes up. Ultimately, we hope the guidance document will help you avoid situations like the one in Michigan and in Hawaii that was presented earlier. We believe that these situations could have been avoided if the states have used the recommendations and suggestions presented in the guidance document. To conclude our presentation, we'd like to encourage you to review the guidance document and try out the long-term stewardship plan. We've covered a lot of information today, so if you'd like to go back and review the presentation, an archive of this training session will be available through ITRC. Also, please feel free to contact any of the trainers if you have further questions. Our contact information was provided on the slide at the beginning of the PowerPoint presentation, which is available on the website. With that, we'd like to thank you for participating in our training today, and I will turn it back over to our moderator, Juliana.
Thanks, Kevin. We are going to have just a few minutes for your questions, so you're welcome to send those in using that Q&A pod in the lower right or unmute #6 and jump in with questions to ask out loud. We'll also have a quick question and answer break. I'm sorry, we'll also have a quick poll question here. So I've opened up the new poll question, and we do appreciate you answering the poll. I'm going to jump right in with one of the questions that have come in. Do you take into consideration such factors as climate change for long-term stewardship plans? For us in Alaska, that is a big issue.
This is Doug Suter. We have taken that into account in a couple of locations specifically for nuclear power plants that are being decommissioned. The NRC actually asks you to project out about 1,000 years of what would happen. And I've been working on a site on the shore of Lake Michigan, and the area is subject to longshore drift. And the area where the plant is in 1,000 years is going to be part of the lake. So in the very long range, yes. In short range, it would really depend on the circumstance. And I can see that in, river systems or coastal areas that are undergoing really the more traditional erosion and deposition processes rather than something that's slower like sea level rise.
Thank you. I'll also remind all participants, we really do use your feedback. So before you wrap up today, please fill out that feedback form. And in the third bullet, we have a link to the feedback form. If you are interested in a certificate for attending today's class, that's the way to get it. Fill out the form, check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. So the only way to get that right now is to be sure to check that box and submit the feedback form, and you can get a certificate. Even if you're not interested in a certificate, we really do appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. We do use the feedback that you provide. A couple of people have asked, does this long-term tool apply to federal facilities, for example, Hanford?
I would expect Hanford to be all on its own, since it's a, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of remediation effort involved. I'm sure that they would have their own special circumstances.
Yeah, I believe the stewardship tool is voluntary right now. It's not a regulatory requirement. That's just to help you craft a very good and viable institutional control.
Thank you. And again, for our phone line audience, it's #6 to unmute if you'd like to jump in with a question. And if you are online and have raised a hand, you are welcome to type in a question using the Q&A pod. Right now, we do not have audio available from our online audience. So if you're on the phone line, you can unmute and ask a question. If you're online only, it's that Q&A pod where you can send in your question. Looking at our poll results, we're about evenly split between people who are ready to use ITRC's guidance for long-term contaminant management and those who need to learn more. And for everyone, the guidance document is available online, and we do hope that it becomes a tool that you can use in your job. We had a question come in earlier about a concern that the IC monitoring does not contain any collection of data or sampling to confirm that the IC, which are part of a remedy selected in a record of decision, is performing as it should. Can our trainers comment on that?
This is Lynn. I'm assuming that the question is in reference to monitoring the tool as the monitoring, or if it was the section earlier that spoke. But if it's the tool, you have the flexibility to put any information in there that you want monitored. If you want somebody to collect groundwater samples at quarterly and include that in the documentation that they monitored the fencing around the IC tool or the IC boundaries, then you would just add that to your table and indicate how frequently you'd want the monitoring, what kind of reporting you'd want on that, and who would be responsible for that. And you could even add some text within that section of your long-term stewardship plan that describes more detail about, you know, more detail than you put in the table if you'd like. I'm not sure that answers the question.
This is Mike Swinsky. I'll just chime in. I think that is correct, of course, Lynn. But I think also the question was focusing on slide 42, which was one I gave. And I think it's really just a matter of semantics, long-term stewardship versus institutional controls. The slide 42 was focused specifically on institutional control monitoring, which we purposely segregated out to be those series of things that's looking for activities could be in conflict with the requirements of an institutional control, like don't do this, don't do that. There's, and in many sites, there's clearly a place for environmental sampling too, which is to test the soil, groundwater, et cetera. But we just define that under, you know, the broader umbrella of long-term stewardship. I think some people would call it operation and maintenance type of stuff. And in the smaller area of institutional control monitoring, we just limited to a smaller set of things.
Thank you. We are about out of time for today's class. It also appears we're out of questions. So if you do have a question that we have not addressed or we haven't completely addressed your question, email us at training@itrcweb.org, and then we'll follow up with you to get the trainers to help answer that question.